The Cinema Specialist Phil and John are back, and today we continue our top 10 movie series, and we are discussing the 10 best movies ever released on Christmas Day. Become a very big holiday for movie releases, and one where a lot of good movies have been coming out. So we're going to be diving into that and discussing. This is only movies released on Christmas Day. There's a couple of movies where they got a wide release on Christmas Day. If they came out like 2 days before in a very limited fashion, but then their main release was Christmas Day, that was, we counted that. But a movie like A Licorice Pizza, which came out in November and then got a wide release on Christmas Day, like that one doesn't count. That's way too much of a difference. And obviously, if you're at the Cannes Film Festival, TIFF, any of that stuff, like I'm not going to knock you and say, oh, your release was in May. No. If your normal release was Christmas Day, it's not that hard to figure out. So that's what we're going with. And I will say my list is pretty much dominated by new movies because, John, we went through a list.
Mm-hmm.
Most of this is new movies. This is a relatively 90s onward trend.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear just based on the release dates that we did see and the research we did for this podcast. This was something that happened come the 90s and moving on to even the 90s, it was kind of sparse and limited, and it really started picking up in the late 90s into the early aughts and has continued on, and it's become this very big tradition. Christmas Day is, if I'm not mistaken, the single biggest box office day of the year in America,
probably. And
if you, when we're going through all these movies, we're looking at these movies, these aren't, there's no Christmas movies among the bunch because you don't release a Christmas movie on Christmas because you want people to see it in the lead up to Christmas. These aren't like family movies for the most part. There's the odd family movie, but these tend to be big movies that are getting that end of year release for an Oscar push.
Uh-huh. I have one family movie on my list.
I definitely do not.
Yeah, I have one family movie on my list, and that is it. So, yeah. And really, it's kind of a cheat because it wasn't really a theatrical release because it happened during COVID. So it was more theatrical happened a little bit later, but this movie was released on Christmas Day in 2020. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get into it though. This was a fun little exercise because you really got to see like. The Exorcist came out the day after Christmas.
Yeah.
Okay. Like the day after Christmas, The Exorcist was released in 1973. So a lot to talk about here. And it's kind of interesting just to see who kind of dominates this day. A lot of Leonardo DiCaprio, a lot yes. of Quentin Tarantino, a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson. And part of me does wonder, is that kind of the clientele of your Christmas Day movie going experience? The guys who aren't going home for Christmas, maybe live away from their families, and so they're going to the movies, or they just spent all day with the family and now they're going to go catch a nighttime showing of one of these movies. That tends to be where everything goes with these Christmas Day releases. So it'll be fun to go through this list. There were some movies as we were going where I was like, there's no way. And even my number one on this list, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, I was like, why the hell was that released on Christmas Day? Like, what yeah. was it? You had too much fun today, so now you got to go want to be absolutely miserable. So this is going to be a fun little exercise, and I'm curious what people will think about this. What are the Christmas Day releases this year?
Nosferatu.
That's right. That's right. And that's and the what? Big one. And a complete unknown.
Nosferatu, a complete unknown. That new A24 movie with Nicole Kidman.
Oh, Baby Girl.
Baby Girl.
Okay.
It's just the big, like, Nosferatu is the big one this year, I would say, but a complete unknown probably also the big one because it's getting a pretty, like, a lot yeah, of award buzz now.
Yeah.
Nosferatu, I think, also has this trend of there are a lot of horror movies that get released on Christmas Day for mm-hmm. some reason.
You talk or about at the least around Christmas, right? As like counter programming.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just very interesting to see this type of thing, but this year's Christmas could be arguably one of the best ever. And yeah. I mean, probably contending with, it'll be interesting to see. I think 2019 probably has the most entries on our top tens, but we'll see.
Yeah. I have to get ready for what year these movies came out. I know that one. I know most of them by year, but we'll have to see when we actually get there. All right, let's get into this because we tend to go long on these. I actually have 10. I'm going to count again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I didn't forget the Muppet Christmas Carol this time. This is my locked-in list. I almost had to change things when John said, what about Licorice Pizza? And I was like, no, John, no. And then thankfully, it actually wasn't a release. So that worked. So let's talk here. Number 10, John, where do you start?
I'm starting us in 1997 with As Good As It Gets.
I'm surprised you like this movie.
I love this movie. This movie is great.
Do you really? Okay, that surprises me. Why? What is it about this one that isn't sappy enough to keep it off your list?
What are you talking about? You know I love sappy movies.
Oh, my God. No, this really surprises me that this made your list. I figured this would have been the type of movie that you would have been like corny, cheesy, whatever. How does it break through the solid stone wall of John?
It is a little cheesy and corny and like, when we get into it, the relationship between Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt as it develops towards the end of the movie does feel like the weakest part of the film. But I think this investigation into this miserable character and his desire just to be good, that and the progression that Jack Nicholson does. Jack Nicholson's performance, like an all-timer in this film. Mm-hmm. Helen Hunt also gets nominated for an Oscar at this one, also does a phenomenal job. This movie just, it feels so real. This idea of like, we spend so much of our time in our own worlds that we're not paying attention to the people around us a lot of the time. And that maybe sometimes when we do start paying attention to the people around us, it'll actually make us happier people. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen this movie in a while. This came out in an unbelievably stacked year. We always talk about 97, LA Confidential, As Good As It Gets, Good Will Hunting, Boogie Nights wasn't even up for Best Picture, Titanic for all the problems that movie has, one of the biggest movies of all time. And then the fifth movie that was nominated there was The Full Monty, which is actually pretty entertaining. It's not great, but it's pretty entertaining. But so As Good As It Gets was kind of like forgotten a little bit, but cleaned up at the Oscars. Helen Hunt and Jack Nicholson both won Oscars. If it wasn't for James Cameron, James L. Brooks probably ends up winning Best Director. It's funny because nowadays we'll talk about L.A. Confidential and Good Will Hunting more, but As Good As It Gets fits in there. Nicholson does give an incredible performance in this movie, and I always love the part where he's just like, is this really As Good As It Gets? Like the fact of like where the name of the movie comes from isn't like my life is as good as it. This is great. It's coming from like it has to get better than this. This can't be it. So yeah, I like As Good As It Gets. I'm just surprised it made your list.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is like this is – I'm actually surprised you're surprised that I like this movie because this does feel like the type of movie that I really like.
Well, there's like an actual plot and it's entertaining and, you know, it's mainstream-ish. I mean, that's not really your cup of tea, right?
That's true. It is a little mainstream-ish, but I just felt like even all the little bits as we start the film – and we see how miserable Jack Nicholson's character is as a human being. I mean, this movie literally starts with Jack Nicholson putting a dog in a garbage chute.
I know.
But, like, that dog is the catalyst that changes his life and makes him realize he doesn't have to be this grumpy curmudgeon all the time. It's just fascinating. And I think, like, it's so human. And that's really what it gets down to. And that's what I like with a lot of, like, the movies that the very top of my top 100, right? Those are all movies about the human experience and just being human and the relationships between humans. And this movie just does it really, really well.
Yeah. It doesn't make my list, but I do appreciate it. And very underrated performance in this movie is Greg Kinnear. Greg Kinnear never gets talked about for this movie because, again, overshadowed by Spacey, Pierce, Burt Reynolds, Robin Williams, Russell Crowe, like all of those people, and half of them weren't even nominated for the Oscar that year, but he just gets overshadowed because bigger names and bigger movies kind of do it. I'm going to start off with War. You guys like War? Here we go. Let's start off with some War because I got two War movies coming at you right off the bat. And the first one I'm doing, and I want to type it in first, is The Thin Red Line. So Terrence Malick's war movie that came out the same year as Saving Private Ryan. While everybody was crying that Saving Private Ryan lost to Shakespeare in Love, this is the movie they actually should have been crying lost to Shakespeare in Love, even though I still find Shakespeare in Love to be a superior movie to both. This is, it's so bizarre to see Terrence Malick make a war movie. Because as you know, Terrence Malick's not going to actually make a war movie when he says, I'm going to make a war movie. You know, it's all the introspection and the, you know, it's so many characters. I mean, this was the one, I'm surprised Sean Penn ever worked with Malick again, because he complained after The Tree of Life. And it's like, dude, what did you expect after seeing The Thin Red Line? This movie has Sean Penn, Adrian Brody, Jim Caviezel, Ben Chaplin, George Clooney, John Cusack, Woody Harrelson, Elias Koteas, Nick Nolte, John C. Reilly, John Travolta. Doesn't even get into the fact that John Savage is also in this movie. Tim Blake Nelson is in this movie. Jared Leto is in this movie. Just like Kirk Acevedo, Nick Stahl, dude, it is so insane how many people are in this movie. Thomas Jane has a random scene. And it's not like, again, when you get into a Malick movie, you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. And this does kind of go the route of Black Hawk Down, of so many characters that at times it's like, okay, who, if I didn't recognize these people, this would mean nothing to me. But it's such a beautiful, beautiful movie. Absolutely stunning to look at. Great performances across the board. The war that is in there is solid. Just a really, really well-made movie. And one that, again, as we're talking about this, does get overlooked, because while it was a Christmas Day release, Terrence Malick's name does not carry the amount that other names do. And this comes out the same year as Saving Private Ryan. The fact that two war movies were both nominated for Best Picture is pretty insane. But Saving Private Ryan obviously gets more of the credit because it is the more easily digestible of these movies, even though I do think The Thin Red Line is the better one. So yeah, Thin Red Line, if you haven't checked it out, definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I need to. This kind of comes into one of the interesting things about me doing my research for this podcast is all these Christmas Day releases are like 2.5+ hour
They're so
movies.
Long.
They're so long. And it's just across the board. There's the occasional one that's like an hour 45, but for the most part, they are all super long. So it makes it hard to watch a lot of them in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And The Thin Red Line is just one that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah. No, it's very much worth it. It really is. And yeah, check that out. Next, I'm going to 1917. So again, I'm just sticking with war. 1917, the Best Picture nominee that ultimately lost out to Parasite. And Sam Mendes did not end up winning his Oscar for Best Director, which I feel like he, maybe you could argue, should have. This movie, look, Parasite's a masterpiece, but the way 1917 is put together is really incredible, and it's such a great watch. And this is kind of a, I would go as far as to say 1917 is officially an underrated movie. 1917 has kind of fallen by the wayside a little bit because of all of the hype around Parasite when it came out, and then the fact that 2020 was such a downer year. I feel like people weren't like, oh man, in 2020 I just got to watch war movies. This came out right before the pandemic started, obviously a Christmas Day release. It had about 2 months. Mm-hmm. People don't really talk about 1917 all that much anymore. I feel like it's one of those movies that it came out, it happened, and then people moved on. But I remember watching that. The intensity just ramps up the entire time. It's so impressive, the editing techniques. It's so funny to me that this movie, I think, along with Birdman, did not win the Oscar for Best Editing, which is just so funny because it's like, do you guys realize like the technique that goes into this movie being able to look the way it does? Which, to answer my own question, no, most of the people who vote, I guess, don't. They want the flashy edits, but let me see. Because this is actually, you know, yeah, Ford versus Ferrari got it because, you know,
of course.
Yeah. That's what should win because like if you have a million cuts, you're a better editor than making a movie look like it's one take when it's 2.5 hours long. So, yeah, Judd Dangle here, that shot of him running with the explosions in the background was crazy. I mean, that is just like beautiful cinema. And yeah, so that's my number 9 is 1917.
I haven't seen 1917, and this is kind of one of the issues with like Christmas Day releases sometimes. Sometimes they come out at a bad time. This is also the last year that I didn't watch all of the Oscar nominees, too.
Mm.
So it's kind of in this blank spot. I was more intrigued by some of the other nominees that year. So I prioritized going to see them instead. And 1917, I don't know. At that time, I wasn't like, yeah, let's go to a war movie. So it's just kind of like slid by. And like you said, it's not one people talk about that much very often anymore. Like, I know I have like some teacher friends who, you know, they'll throw it on for their history classes or whatever every once in a while. But it is one that the general population hasn't really talked about, despite the fact that it does have a director like Sam Mendes attached to it. Like, it does have a big name director attached to it. And it is, it was very revered when it came out. People could not stop talking about this movie in 2019.
People thought that this was going to ultimately pull out the victory because Parasite was an international movie and people didn't think that the Oscars would ever vote for an international movie to actually pull out the win. I mean, Parasite ultimately is the better movie, but 1917 was a really solid one that had it won would have been good. John, you mentioned that 2019 was the last time you didn't see all the Best Picture nominees. You know what the last year was that I didn't see all the Best Picture nominees?
No.
1996.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sitting there. I haven't seen Secrets and Lies and Shine. Those are the two movies. Those are the most recent movies that came out that I have not seen that were nominated for Best Picture. So that's a fun fact about me. I didn't realize it went that far back. Oh, I had I had 2000 was a rough year for me because I hadn't seen Aaron Brockovich. I hadn't seen Chocolat and I hadn't seen Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And I saw all three of those. And then every other year between those, I was like, oh, I've seen all these. So, yeah, Secret and Lies and Shine.
There you go. Got to get on it.
I know. I was cooking through those, and then I just had no – dude, this year was a rough year in terms of actually sitting down to watch movies. I've had a hard time getting the time, but hopefully 2025 brings it back. What's your number nine?
Well, speaking of 2019 Best Picture nominees, my number nine is Little Woman, which I was very surprised when I decided that this was actually fitting onto my list, but – this movie is just so impressive. What Greta Gerwig's able to do with this period, making it feel so relevant. This story from 150 years ago, making it feel so relevant to today. And I mean, the performances, especially from Saoirse Ronan, are just all phenomenal right across the board.
I'm scared. Sorry, I was looking up Saoirse Ronan because Saoirse Ronan like keeps like making all these statements and stuff. I'm kind of scared that Saoirse Ronan's career is like, where is she? What's going on?
Did she have like a bunch of movies that just came out this year?
Did she?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And like highly acclaimed performances too, I'm pretty sure.
Were they? Because my biggest thing is this. Why isn't Saoirse Ronan still getting like these Oscar noms like crazy? Because she's only 30. So she just turned 30 this year. And I mean, for a while there with Brooklyn, Lady Bird, Little Women, and the Grand Budapest Hotel. It's like, man, she was cooking. And now I'm like, hey, Saoirse, where are you? What's going on? Get back out here. She's like, I truly think she's like the best living actress. So like, I just love Saoirse Ronan. And I hope that her career wasn't a youthful career and that she continues to get roles as she gets older. Because I need more Saoirse Ronan.
Yes, we do. And like I said, she's so phenomenal in this movie. She's definitely... I mean, her playing Jo in Little Women is just, she's definitely the main protagonist of that story and the narrator of that story. But the emotion, the rawness, just that feeling of the story of Little Women itself, I didn't think would really appeal to me all that much. Just because like, I don't tend to like a lot of literature from that time. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of these little moments in the film and the way that Greta Gerwig decided to capture them in the performances of everyone in it and stuff, it's just really I connected to it on a level that I didn't think was possible for a story like this. Mm-hmm. That like it's kind of framed as this romance, but really it's this story of ambition and desire and place in the world and how you find it and what values you have. And how is your value determined? All framed through this, like the relationships of these sisters. It's just, it honestly shocked me at how good of a film this was, despite all the acclaim it did get when it was released and everything like that. It just took me a while to get to it. But this is, 2019 is one heck of a year for film.
Yeah, 2019 was really solid. And that's why it's a bummer. Like, I have felt that 2020 obviously messed everything up because of COVID. And then we've had a tough recovery. And I found myself when I was doing my top 100 list, you know, as now that I'm on the north side of 30 and, you know, you're quickly approaching mid 30s and all of that, John, you got your birthday coming up before mine because you're an old man. Yep. I'm not. But as you start approaching that, you start saying to yourself, okay, I just did my top 100. I only have one movie that came out since 2020. And I'm like, oh no, have I hit that part of my life where it's like, oh, the good old days, you guys, they're not making movies like 2019. Oh, like nothing could be good. I mean, it's like, I think the only movie that my dad would ever say is in like his top 100 that came out since 2000 is probably freaking The Secret in Their Eyes. You know what I mean? Like the original, not the dog shit Hollywood remake. But it's just funny because like I started thinking that and then I'm like, wait, 2020 was a COVID year, so there was nothing. 2021 was the remnants of whatever we could scrap together and get going. 2022 was okay, but it was still, we're trying to figure it out. 2023, what were the best picture nominees for 2023? 2023 Oscar.
So last year?
Yeah, that was last year.
What won best picture last year?
Why can I not think of what won? Oppenheimer. Oh, like, yeah, obviously. Right. Yeah, all of a sudden last year I started saying The Holdovers, Oppenheimer, Anatomy of a Fall, The Zone of Interest. I'm like,
okay, yeah, there were some good movies last year.
We're getting back now. And now this year I haven't seen much, but I feel like I've avoided the movies almost because I have felt a little disappointed in what's come out. And that's because you had the actor strike and you had the director strike. So you had both a writer strike. I'm sorry. You had both of these strikes happening and that made the quality of film go down. And we didn't see a lot of big names make movies. I was looking at the Golden Globes the other day.
Yeah.
When the biggest name for best director is Edward Berger for nominee, that's crazy. Normally they'll throw a bone to somebody major. Sean Baker, Edward Berger. Those are the only two names I even really know. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Good. Let's get more young directors. I've said too much that with indie film falling off, a lot of young directors get their shot with doing like a Marvel movie. And if the movie's not good, those directors disappear. They don't actually form their own like talent or anything. But I started to realize that and I'm like, oh, it's not me. It's them. And that made me feel better because, you know, I'm hoping that some of these movies will start to pop up. But yeah, 2019, I was like, is that the last great year of film? And it's like, no, the film industry just kind of ate itself alive for no reason.
And again, like world circumstances also kind of prevented things for a while, but
yeah,
I'm sure we'll get back there eventually. We just have to get through it first, right? Give it another year or two and we should get another big one, I'm sure.
Hopefully. Yeah. All right. What's your number eight?
My number eight is, like you said in the intro, right? It's Christmas Day is kind of ruled by PTA. PTA has a lot of films that release on Christmas Day. Even Licorice Pizza, which did have the Select City release earlier on, I'm fairly certain I went on Christmas Day to see this movie in theaters in 2021, or to see Licorice Pizza in 2021. But number eight, I'm giving it to The Phantom Thread, which is one of those PTA movies that just isn't talked about anywhere nearly enough for how good of a film it is.
Phantom Thread grows and grows and grows and grows and grows and grows every time I watch it. I have Phantom Thread a little bit higher up on my list, but I do have Phantom Thread.
I just feel like, first off, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is absolutely spectacular in this film, as he is in almost anything he does. But this is one of those films. It is so hard to watch. There's a lot of malice and hatred in this film, masses love, and such a toxic relationship between these characters. And it's performed in such a beautiful way. The cinematography is absolutely stupendous. And it feels so sad and scary almost in a way as you get to the end of this film. And it's not really fair that like a bottom third PTA film is still a perfect film.
I know. He's so ridiculously good. I mean, I love the ending of this movie. Like the twist was so good. The acting is great. It looks beautiful. It's one of those movies when you sit down and you watch it the first time, you're like, okay, that was a good movie, but I didn't know where it was going. And PTA had, you know, he makes his solid movies, but he also has some movies where you're like, what's going on? And then the more you think about this one, the more you're like, holy shit, that is just such a perfectly, perfectly, perfectly well-made movie. So I have this higher. We'll get to it in a sec. And then we'll go from there, I guess. But Now we'll get into my number eight. I have The Sting, which we just did as our movie for $5 Tuesday. So that was the one we just put out. The 1973 Best Picture winner that ultimately defeated The Exorcist, which I disagree with, but it did happen. And this is a fun movie. This is like a buddy comedy. It's the second movie that Paul Newman and Robert Redford made together. It's the final movie the two of them made together, and it just works. I mean, John, I didn't talk about it in the $5 Tuesdays thing, but like the whole like nose thing that he does at the end, I'm like, damn, the amount of times, like if people still knew what this movie was, you could just do that and it'd be like, hey, I'm in on this, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a great heist crime movie, but it's masked as like a buddy comedy, and it's so expertly written. The screenwriting is just tremendous. So this is one of those movies that kind of gets a little bit forgotten, I feel like, from a Best Picture conversation, especially when you look at the 70s. You know, if you really roll through the 70s, you're talking Patton, you're talking, what was 70, French Connection, The Godfather, The Sting, The Godfather Part Two, and then you get into 75, which is Cuckoo's Nest, Rocky, Annie Hall. 78 brings you to... was The Deer Hunter 78 or 79? The Deer Hunter is 78, and then Kramer versus Kramer is 79. So when you look at that, it's not surprising that The Sting kind of falls into maybe the seventh or eighth best movie to Best Picture in the 70s. But it's such a fun movie, and it's so different from the rest of those, and it just shows how great the 70s was. I mean, just listing those movies, it's stupid. Yeah. And then don't even get me into what they all beat, because those movies are incredible too. But The Sting is really fun. And it's a different take on the 70s, and it's set in the 30s, Chicago crime. It's worth a watch, and everybody should check it out. So that's what I got.
Yeah, I have this thing a little higher, so I'll save my thoughts on it for now. But yeah, great film.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you have it higher. All right, my number seven. So this is where this is a little bit of a cheat. It's not much of a cheat, but it's a little bit of a cheat. I have Soul, the Pixar movie, which was supposed to release theatrically. Then because it was COVID, they weren't sure when it was going to be able to release. So they held it off, and then they released it on Disney Plus on Christmas Day. I thought this movie was just so incredible. And this was really the moment where it was like, man, Pixar stopped making movies that were even like remotely for kids. Like this movie is so dark, and it's so heady. And it's just like the music and everything in it is so good. The animation is like some of the greatest of all time. It's a shame because Pixar really hasn't touched this, in my opinion, since they made this movie. Like Inside Out 2, I know people really enjoyed that. I'm just not a fan of the Inside Out movies. And then they did like Elemental and stuff. They got so deep and so dark with this movie. And this really is truly in the running for the best Pixar movie. And that's saying a lot. Now, granted, I'm always going to have Wall-E and Up ahead of this, but this is like, if somebody were to say to me Soul is my favorite Pixar movie, I wouldn't raise an eyebrow. I'd just be like, yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah, if you haven't checked this one out, it really got screwed by the fact of when it came out. You know, it was supposed to release, and this COVID thing just kept pushing it back, and it probably doesn't get the love it deserves as a winner, like, or as an animated feature winner from Pixar.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've only seen this the one time when it first came out, and I did enjoy it. Like you said, it is a darker Pixar movie. It has a bit more depth to it, even though Pixar movies usually have a lot of depth. It's really towing the line, again, between like that human condition, what is the purpose of life, and what are we doing, and all that. It's really one I need to revisit, because it is really well done. Obviously, the jazz music in it is great, and it just... It almost feels like, because this was released on Disney Plus, and thankfully it was released on Disney Plus on Christmas Day without the caveat of pay $20 for this movie.
God, they started doing that after, right?
Yeah, but this, it does kind of just like fall off when people think of the Pixar movies. People don't think about it. And I think because it wasn't as successful as other Pixar movies, that's kind of why we haven't seen Pixar revisit these type of themings and then going this far into films again. And it's why we're kind of in this weird period where it's like, okay, Pixar, what are you actually doing now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. And they don't know what they're doing right now.
No,
they're just like, we're going to make a sequel, and then everything original that we do, I mean, it's just not hitting. And I think maybe because they've let Disney maybe have too much of an impact on their films that are coming out, but Disney and Pixar like are kind of both needing to do a big look inside, because Pixar used to be nothing but hits. And after Soul, they did Luca, Turning Red, Lightyear, Elemental. Like, none of those movies are worth my time. None of those movies. They're 2.5 stars at best. Yeah. And then Inside Out 2, which, like I said, I'm not a big Inside Out fan. I mean, before that, they did Onward, which obviously, again, came out a week before COVID. So what are you really going to do with that? Toy Story 4, Incredibles 2, those aren't original ideas. 2017 was the last time they had a solid original idea with Coco, other than Soul. So, yeah, I really love Soul. And, yeah, that's why I got it here at number 7.
Yep.
What's your 7, John?
Well, we've talked about people who kind of rule Christmas, PTA, Tarantino. We didn't mention Scorsese, but he's had a few come out on Christmas Day as well. But there is one big name we forgot to mention who is very pivotal to Christmas releases. And that's the bard, William Shakespeare.
Mm.
Shakespeare movies come out on Christmas a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to the most recent one with 2021's The Tragedy of Macbeth. The Joel Cohen produced, directed, written...
Which now I need to watch this week, because this will be our $5 Tuesday.
Yeah. This is the first solo effort by Joel Cohen. We already talked about Ethan Cohen's solo effort earlier this year with Driveway Dolls, but Joel Cohen's work much better by himself than his brother's solo work. This is a spectacular film. This is one of the most stunning looking Shakespeare adaptations I've ever seen. It's like almost word for word direct performance of it. It is very minimalist. It is led by a killer performance by Denzel Washington and Denzel Washington as Macbeth, Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth. It's just an all-around fascinating adaptation of the most, I believe it's the most, Macbeth is the most adapted Shakespeare play.
More than Romeo and Juliet, really?
I think so. I think it's at 14 adaptations.
But does that count all of the fake adaptations of Romeo and Juliet that aren't
I'm
like
not 100%.
There's two West Side Stories?
I know. But I think like direct adaptations, at least, it is the most adapted of his works. And there's a reason why. And there's a reason why Macbeth is kind of like one of the tragedies that's like studied. I actually don't know. Is it studied down in the States too?
Yeah.
Studied up here, right? Like it's one of the there's a reason why Macbeth is one of the more popular Shakespeare plays, and that's because it has all of these beautiful themes of is there supernatural forces at play, or is it just like, you know, is there some mental illness going on here, is there some just consciousness? And obviously, like we've talked about for a Macbeth adaptation previously on the podcast when we talked about Throne of Blood. But this one, as just like this true performance, it feels like a stage play, but it's shot in a way that a stage play could never actually capture. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's done so well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to watch it this week because it will be our Tuesday movie. So I got nothing really to say about it, but I'll check it out. It was one of those where the hype was real, but it really didn't get much in terms of nominations and everything. It got Denzel got nominated, I think, but that was it.
Yeah, which is weird because it was 2021. You would think more would
have
been drawn to this, but
they weren't. what do you have at 6?
I have this thing at 6.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah. And like you said, this is just one of these perfect buddy comedies, but also crime movies. I think one of the things that really, and I mentioned this in our $5 Tuesday, one of the things that really bugged me about this thing the first time was like the title cards that we get throughout it. But upon a rewatch of it, they're so pivotal because it makes you realize that you are also a student of what's going on. Just like the way that Hooker is the student of Paul Newman in this movie, right?
Like, yeah, Gondorf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just so interesting to see the perspective that the audience is put in while watching this film. And it's just done so well. It's one of the best crime movies ever made, which is saying a lot because there are a lot of crime movies on this particular list that we are doing right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I like this Sting a lot. Like I said, I already had it in there at number 8, so a little bit lower than you, but I really enjoy this Sting, and it's one of the few movies that we both had pop up here. My number 6 is Phantom Thread, so not much further ahead than you had Phantom Thread. We literally just swapped our 6 and 8. It's just like it's Daniel Day-Lewis. He's so good in this movie, and it's so subtle in this one. And I think that's what's most impressive. But then at the same time, the performances from Vicky Creeps, I never heard how to say her last name, and then Leslie Manville.
Yeah.
Those performances are also so unbelievable. And like this to me, what this movie, what I would compare this most to is Barry Lyndon, right?
Yes.
Because it is gorgeous to look at. It feels like it should be a period piece, but it's in the hands of one of the most talented directors of all time, who is saying this movie is so much more than what you think it is. And that's where I would go as my comparison would be Barry Lyndon with Phantom Thread. So I love Phantom Thread. I think it's a super entertaining movie. I think it's really, really, really impressive. And yeah, it just doesn't really get the love that it probably should. I mean, I know PTA, he's hit or miss with some people in some of his recent movies. This should have been a universal hit, and I'm surprised it wasn't.
Yeah, it did get a little bit of Oscar attention. You would expect that from the Academy when it comes to a PTA movie starring Daniel Day-Lewis. But it really is one of the ones that isn't really spoken about when it comes to PTA's filmography. And again, this is kind of like, if I'm doing my rankings of PTA films, this is probably like 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
So like it is in his lower half of films, in lower third of films, but it's still absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, it's so good. And you were talking about with Oscars, it was nominated for picture, director, actor, supporting actress, like, and then it wins costume design, obviously. But yeah, really good movie. Really, really good movie. What's next? I have my number 5, right? That's what we're up to here.
Yeah.
All right, so my number 5 is finally, John, is it getting a little chilly up by you?
What are you getting at right now?
Is it a little chilly up by you?
I mean, yeah, I'm living in Canada. It's the winter.
It has nothing to do with your freezing cold takes.
Oh, okay. Well, I see. I know what this is now.
I have The Wolf of Wall Street at my number 5. John insulted me without even having the decency to call me on the phone and say it. I love The Wolf of Wall Street, man. This movie is chaos the whole time. And this was really like, so this is what I love about Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese can make a 4-hour movie about, you know, that is a crime movie that is so slow and confident and evenly paced and just takes its time and everything is subtle. And then he can turn around and he can make this movie, which is sporadic chaos, drugs, violence, sex, all of that. And it's just out of control. I think this movie is so funny. I think it is so entertaining. I think Jonah Hill in this movie is so underrated. I think he is so funny in this. I love Rob Reiner playing Leonardo DiCaprio's dad. That is such a funny performance. Leo himself is great. I love the stylistic choices that are made in this movie from Scorsese, with Leonardo DiCaprio breaking the fourth wall, with the whole situation with Jean Dujardin out in Switzerland. Like, I just think this movie is so much fun. And it has Margot Robbie in it as legitimately the hottest anybody has ever appeared on film. So yeah, that's also a nod in its favor. But Wolf of Wall Street's my number 5. This movie is very entertaining, and John's going to call me a dude, bro, dumbass or something now.
I wasn't going to, but now I have to because
now that I put it out there.
Now that I put it out there, I have to say, I hadn't watched The Wolf of Wall Street. It was one of those ones where, okay, this movie's 3 hours long. I'm not a big Scorsese fan, and I think everyone who's listening to the podcast at this point knows I'm not the biggest Scorsese fan. I do love his slow burn crime films. I think those are fantastic, but it's the other side of his filmography that I'm just not a big fan of, and this falls into that other side of his filmography that I'm not a big fan of. Of the nearly 20 movies I did research of for this podcast, it ended up as the bottom. Now granted, it's still like I don't know. What did they end up giving it? 2 stars? Or did they give it lower? Did they give it 1.5? I can't
remember. I don't know. I got to send in the clown picture. I don't know. I got to find that. Yeah, I'm more worried about finding Chuckles the Clown over here. I got nothing for you here.
I give it 2.5. So that also, I think, just speaks to the quality of films that come out on Christmas Day. Is that this is my lowest rated at 2.5. So that's still like an enjoyable enough film. And I did enjoy the film. I think, like you said, Leonardo DiCaprio does a great job in this. His performance in this is spectacular. And this is kind of the reason why. I think this is a lot of the reason why people think Leonardo DiCaprio is like one of like the greatest actors of all time. Because of this, even though if you watch some of his other movies, you can see he's not the greatest of all time, but that's fine. This is just one of those movies, and I think about the impact this movie had on society afterwards, and I think that probably takes it down, and maybe it's unfair to do that, but you can't look at this movie and not say this is a total dude bro movie. This movie literally is the reason why crypto got so out of hand.
Oh yeah, but I mean, like, that's okay, so
but that's why. Like, it's because it has that like effect on people where it has like, you're supposed to watch this movie and the entire time you are supposed to think Leonardo DiCaprio's character is a total piece of shit. And it's very clear that's what Stacey's trying to do in the film. But there are so many people out there who admire him.
I mean, I don't necessarily not admire him. I mean, but
that's what I mean when I'm talking about like the film bro people who like really like this movie. Is that one those type of people who will sit there misinterpret this movie, like the people who sit there and misinterpret Fight Club and not realize it's actually ragging on those type of.
Where movies, did you right? have Fight? Did you have Fight Club in your top 100?
Not my most recent one.
Oh, but did you have it in your top 100?
I did. I enjoy that film for the message it's actually trying to say.
Yeah, that's what you want us to think, dude, bro. You're right. Here's a question for you, legitimately. What's the best performance of Leonardo DiCaprio's career?
That's a great question. I have to think about that.
Because to me, it's this.
It's the best he's ever done. It might be this.
It's either this or Django. Because he's ridiculous in Django.
Sure.
And he didn't get the nomination in Django. Or he did get the nomination in Django. Did he not? He didn't. I don't think he did. I think they gave it to Samuel Jackson. No, they gave it to Christoph Waltz. Christoph Waltz was nominated.
Yeah.
And Leonardo DiCaprio wasn't. Leonardo DiCaprio should have been nominated and probably should have won that year. But I think that this is his best performance. I love him.
It's either this or probably one of the Tarantino films he did. Probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, we can get off that. What's your number five?
My number five, we're going back to Shakespeare, but this time we're going for the very, very long,
jeez,
word-for-word adaptation, 1996, Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet.
Great movie. Hard to watch because it's so long.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's over 4 hours long, but this is the pinnacle of like word-for-word Shakespeare adaptations in my mind. This is absolutely spectacular. Hamlet's also my favorite Shakespeare play, so again, there's a little bit of bias going into this. And Kenneth Branagh's my answer to if you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be? And a lot of it stems from my experience with this movie as a kid growing up. I think the direction in this film is absolutely spectacular. I think Kenneth Branagh's performance as Hamlet is both ridiculous and so, so good. It just captures this indecisiveness of the Danish prince so well. And as we progress through this, again, very long movie, it's presented in a way where it doesn't feel long to me. Right, like Kenneth Branagh does such a good job with his direction and the adaptation that he has created for this version of Hamlet while starring in it as well, that it feels like so evenly paced as you go through this story of Hamlet and you just see the tragedy that unfolds throughout this play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a beautiful movie, man. I love it. It looks amazing. I mean, you know, it's so old at this point, you know, 30 years almost, but it still looks incredible. Like this was built for, you know, 4K and all of that. I mean, I love this movie. And I mean, I haven't seen it in a very long time because, again, this is like one of those movies you watch and then you're like, okay, I can't fit this in. Like, I literally can't fit this in. It's like a Lawrence of Arabia kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's a great movie. And, very fair to have it all the way up here at number five.
Yeah, it's one that I have a friend who literally watches it every Christmas Eve. It's his Christmas Eve movie.
I guess he is doing nothing else.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's worth a watch. If you haven't watched this particular adaptation of Hamlet, and I mean, when you talk about Shakespeare adaptations, there are a lot of people who won't have this listed as their top one. This is definitely one worth watching.
Mm-hmm. All right, what's your number four?
My number four is the first movie that appeared on my original top 100. It didn't come on my revised top 100, but number four is Jackie Brown. It's our first Tarantino today.
Okay. Is it our only Tarantino today?
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't have a Tarantino on my list.
Then yes, it's our only Tarantino today.
There you go.
And that's, to be fair, like the Tarantinos that have gotten the Christmas releases are this, Django and The Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
And I do think The Hateful Eight's pretty underrated, but it just like just didn't make my list.
Mm-hmm.
But Jackie Brown, I rewatched it again today. And that is such a phenomenal Tarantino film. And I get why a lot of people, I still think it's Tarantino's most underappreciated film. And a lot of it probably comes down to the fact it's his follow up to Pulp Fiction, coming off of, you know, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. It's this. Pam Grier, absolutely phenomenal in this film. Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely spectacular. Robert Forrester obviously gets the Oscar nomination for this one and is also spectacular. Even Robert De Niro in his small role in this movie mm-hmm. is so captivating. I mean, I've gone on record saying Robert De Niro is the best actor of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like the way he plays Lewis, this like bum of a character in this movie, like just goes to prove it for me. Samuel L. Jackson, unreal, just doing like the Samuel L. Jackson thing in this movie. It's, and it all comes together with this soul soundtrack that Tarantino does. It has all those Tarantino shots that you see in the films and you expect. And quite frankly, like Jackie Brown is one of the greatest female protagonists ever put to film, in my opinion.
Yeah, we talked about Jackie Brown a while ago back when we did it for the podcast. Like Samuel Jackson in this movie is so, so damn good. He's so mm-hmm. cool and suave and just like performs so well in this. Jackie Brown's a good one. I mean, it is the underrated Tarantino, in my opinion. Yeah. The Hateful Eight, I do enjoy a lot. And I know that's not really the popular opinion, but like Jackie Brown, people don't even really go to it anymore. Like they don't really go back to it because it doesn't have your typical Tarantino cast. Like it has Samuel Jackson, but beyond that, you don't really get your Tarantino people in there. And Pam Grier really like was such a niche casting choice. Brilliant decision.
Brilliant.
But so niche that like it doesn't matter to a lot of moviegoers nowadays. So yeah, Jackie Brown didn't make my list, but Jackie Brown's a damn entertaining movie.
Yeah.
My number four, and this is where I thought you were going with that last one, is Les Mis. So I have Les Mis here at number four. I've always talked about this. I think this is one of the best musicals ever made. We already had this, right? Didn't I put this on a list already?
Our top 10 movie musical list?
Yeah. What number did I have it at? Do you remember?
I can't remember.
I can't either. But anyway, so I have Les Mis. I've already talked so much about Les Mis, but Les Mis comes in here at number four. And I mean, I'm sure you have it on your list or no?
I do. Yeah,
yeah, of course. I'm not going to dive in too much. Just know that Les Mis is my number four. And this is like the last one of my movies that makes sense. It released on Christmas.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, I have Les Mis higher. So I'll talk about it when we get there, I guess.
Yeah. And then my number three is The Revenant. So now we're into familiar territory for me, meaning that we are now officially at my top 100 movies. So The Revenant comes in here at number three, and the other two movies are both also in my top 100. The Revenant's great. We already talked about Leonardo DiCaprio. Honestly, this is probably one of his weakest performances, in my opinion. It's the one he ultimately wins the Oscar for. Not that it's a bad performance. It's just he doesn't have to do anything, really. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very physical. And really, it's the spectacle of this movie. It's what Iñárritu was able to accomplish. Tom Hardy's fantastic. To me, this is just a stunning movie, and it's a shame that people were so hateful on it because it came out after Birdman won Best Picture and everything, I think that people were just like over Iñárritu, but sorry, he made two of the best movies ever made in back-to-back years. That's not his fault. So I got The Revenant at number three.
Yeah, I mean, The Revenant was one that, like, obviously I considered for my list and didn't ultimately make it because I talked about it when we did cover it for the podcast, but the movie, it does it. I mean, sometimes maybe there's a bit of trauma of being in the, like, middle of nowhere, and that just reminds me of my time living in the middle of nowhere. But, like you said, I don't think Leonardo DiCaprio's performance in this is all that good. I think this is just kind of like a lifetime achievement award when he gets the Oscar for this. As a, hey, we probably should have given it to you by this point, but we haven't. I think Tom Hardy was by far the best part of this movie. But Iñárritu does do a good job, and he does capture this desperation that is needed for the movie really well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, anyway, Iñárritu is one of the all-time greats. Need him to make something else soon. Anyway. All right, go. What do you have as your number three?
Well, my number three is definitely on your list because it was in your top 100. It is Magnolia. Mm.
Why was this movie released on Christmas?
PTA does that type of thing, I guess.
Like, he just wanted, he was like, oh, you had a nice Christmas dinner. Now go watch Tom Cruise. That'll be fun.
What could go wrong? Not fun. This is such a sad and heartbreaking film. And it is just, rewatching this yesterday, I was just reminded of how I watched a bunch of PTA movies in the last, I watched three PTA movies in the last week because I did have Licorice Pizza initially on my list before Phil and I decided the select cities was enough that it wasn't just like a limited release, like festival thing. So it wasn't included, but Magnolia is just, it's so spectacular. It is such, there are such broken people. And again, this goes into what I was saying when I was talking about As Good As It Gets and Little Women and a lot of the movies on this list. This is just a movie that investigates broken humans and the human condition and the relationship between humans. And the way PTA frames it all with this like interconnected story of seemingly coincidence and then kind of putting it on, but is it actually coincidence to it? It's so raw. The performance is all around absolutely spectacular. I mean, obviously Tom Cruise, Philip Seymour Hoffman, William H. Macy, spectacular in this movie. Julianne Moore. It's so spectacular and it's all brought together by the sensibility of Paul Thomas Anderson with this beautiful cinematography. And it's heartbreaking film. And I guess I just like being sad on Christmas.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to kill my rankings here because that is my number one. My number two is Children of Men, which is another movie that's on my top 100. So that makes sense. So I'm going to knock both of mine out here. Children of Men 2, Magnolia number one. Children of Men is just like one of the most underrated sci-fi movies ever made. I mean, it's so good. And I think we've hit the date, or we're like 5 years away from the date of the world ending, according to that movie. Or at least people no longer being able to give birth. So Children of Men is stunning. I mean, these are two movies that we've talked about because we did full podcast on Children of Men. We did a full podcast on Magnolia. Magnolia still gets the edge here. Children of Men is a fun, more fun movie, even though it's dark. It's a more fun movie that would make sense to be released on Christmas. Whereas, you know, Magnolia, God, Paul Thomas Anderson, an asshole for that. My God.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned my number one now, which is Children of Men, because it's the only one that's still in my top 100. And my number two is Les Mis. Again, I mentioned this when we did our top 10 movie musicals. Les Mis is the only movie I've seen twice on the same day in theaters. Mm-hmm. So obviously pretty high on my list. I love this musical, undoubtedly. And then Children of Men, like you said, is just one of the most underrated science fiction movies of all time. It does get the appeal. Like, I think it's one, and I think we probably mentioned this when we talked about it on the podcast. This is one of those movies that in the right circles, everyone loves this. But as you are talking to other people about these, like, dystopian future films, this one seems to just not be spoken about anywhere near enough.
Mm-hmm. I think it's because it's Clive Owen.
Probably.
Doesn't mean a lot. Alfonso Cuarón's made other movies that are more popular. Julianne Moore pops up in my number one and my number two. But like, it's just one of those movies where it was a little quiet. Like, this movie coming out in 2006, The Departed also, right? Yeah. This was 2006. Am I making that up?
That sounds right.
Let me make sure. 2006, The Departed, Little Miss Sunshine. Like, there were movies that were just bigger that I think overshadowed this a little bit. It doesn't get the Best Picture nomination, so people don't necessarily go back to it as frequently. And the fact that it's not a massive star that, you know, people talk about all the time. Nobody's doing a ranking of what are the best Clive Owen performances. Yeah. So I think that does hurt the movie a little bit, but this movie's great. And then, yeah, Magnolia, my number one. So we have almost identical top threes. With the exception of I Have the Revenant in there, but yeah. And I have Les Mis at four, but it's, yeah, Les Mis, Children of Men, and Magnolia are pretty much our universal answer to the best movies released on Christmas Day.
I mean, this list could very well be disrupted this year with the releases that are coming out.
Yeah, I agree.
I actually wouldn't be surprised if at least one of those didn't make both of our lists, and it might not even be the same one.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I totally agree. So Nosferatu, we'll see what happens in 6 days. I know. We'll see what happens.
I mean, I'm excited.
I feel like on the 26th, I will probably be in a theater watching that movie. I'm not going to lie. So, but yeah, thank you all so much for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I hope you guys have enjoyed this series so far. We actually don't know what our next topic is, do we? We got to figure that out for January. And we got to start diving in a little bit more. But we're going to be doing the Tragedy Macbeth on Tuesday for $5 Tuesdays. That'll be releasing on Christmas Eve. So go check that out. We will be doing a year-end podcast on the 30th, I think we decided. So make sure to tune in for that one, and we'll get into our year-end review. I'm actually going to go see Anora tomorrow night. So I will finally be able to say that I've actually seen two movies that are nominated for Globes here. Really, it was just a rough year of me getting to the theater, man. It really was. So I'm excited to see Anora finally sit down and watch that movie. And otherwise, that's it. That's what we got. Like this video, subscribe to the channel, and we'll see you all next time.